Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Jeremy Cliff in Berlin.
I'm Emily Tampkin in Washington, D.C.
It's Friday, the 28th of May.
You're listening to World Review from the New Statesman.
Thank you for joining us. Well, we have a first ever World Review episode for you this week, focused on the New Statesman's home country, the UK. So a rare departure for us, but there's a lot of internationally significant material to talk about with regards to British politics. But before we do so, Emily, looking a bit further afield, what do you think has been a moment of the past week that's been historically significant in world?
Yeah, I just think that we shouldn't overlook what's happening in India with Twitter specifically. Obviously, we've spoken a lot about democracy in India and the pandemic in India. But this week, Twitter has accused the police in India of intimidation and has basically said that the police are cracking down on Twitter in India. And I just want to flag this for a couple of reasons. The first is that I think it's worth noting the different postures that social media companies take in the United States or maybe in the UK and farther afield from their home bases, right? I find it very, very hard to believe that Twitter would play a similar role here in the United States and in fact booted Donald Trump from the platform after he instigated violence. I would also just note that Twitter has been one source for Indians to communicate with one another during the pandemic, as their government, as we've heard in previous podcasts, has maybe not been so forthcoming about pandemic relief and from where it will come. And so this is a major source of information that's being cracked down on by the government. If we kind of say, well, that happened in India, we're allowing for one Twitter, one social media experience in the quote unquote West and another in India or in other countries where Twitter is made to contort itself to meet government rules or doesn't and is bullied, is kicked out. So that's one that I will note from this past week. And what about you, Jeremy?
My moment of the week also has a social media dimension to it. I was very struck, as were many, by the news on last Sunday, the 23rd of May, that the Belarusian government had forced down a Ryanair airliner traveling from Athens to Vilnius in Lithuania while it was just about to exit its airspace. They cited an entirely implausible bomb threat and sent up a military jet to accompany this flight to Minsk Airport, where far from rapidly evacuating the plane, as you would expect them to do in the event of a real bomb threat, they extracted a young blogger and opposition activist, Roman Protasevich, and his girlfriend, who had been in exile. They'd left Belarus in 2019, seeking political asylum in Poland. And Mr. Protasevich is now under arrest. He is said to fear that he might end up being given the death penalty. Alexander Lukashenko, Belarus's autocratic president since 1994, has come under challenge from protests in the last year or so, particularly last summer. And Protasevich had been involved in Nexta, which is a Telegram app channel that has been used to organize some of those protests. And that had him put on a list for instigating riots. And he's been accused of terrorism by the Belarusian government. So very, very alarming defiance of international norms. The EU has responded with talk of sanctions, and there have been bans placed on flights from Belarus's national airline. It also looks like a lot of other airlines are now avoiding Belarusian airspace, doubtless concerned that the government could pull the same stunt again. And I think it's significant because it goes to show the extremes to which autocratic governments are increasingly going to crack down on exiles that remain involved in their country's politics particularly through social media. And this is something I write about in my column in the New Statesman this week. You know, we've had other cases like Ruhollah Zam, an Iranian opposition figure in exile in Paris, who was lured to Iraq with the promise of an interview bundled into a car driven across the border to Iran, where he faced the death penalty. You could also talk about Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi commentator and journalist who was murdered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. So just very concerning sign about our sort of age of impunity. And indeed, those who want to read more about this, I'd also recommend to take a look at our colleague Ido Fox's interview with the current editor of the Nexter Telegram channel, Tadeusz Giszczan, who is essentially Protasevich's successor, and talked to Ido about the great concerns that him and his colleagues have about their safety and about the state of the opposition movement. So I think that's very significant and worth continuing to pay attention to.
I just want to flag one thing before we introduce our excellent guest, which is that there has been some chatter, I know here in the United States, I don't know about in the United Kingdom, but basically attempts to smear this young man as a fascist, that he had links to far right movements. And I just want to say that even if that were true, that is not what we're talking about here. Right? He is not, do not delude yourself into thinking that this man was taken to prison because, first of all, that Lukashenko is in any way the defender of like liberal democratic values. And second of all, that what is happening here is because of his political leanings. This is a matter of freedom of the press, and it's a matter of retribution against someone who blogged in an unflattering way about the Belarusian government and police. That is what we were talking about here. It kind of reminded me of the campaign against Navalny and his Alexei Navalny, the Russian opposition figure who was stripped of the title of prisoner of conscience after there was a campaign because he had said hate speech in the past. If you want to say that he should never have been given the title in the first place, that's one thing. But that's not what we're talking about, right? Like, Alexei Navalny is not in prison because he made deeply racist comments about various people. Like, that's not, it's because he's an anti-corruption blogger and opposition figure. Similarly, this did not happen because anybody has political views that Lukashenko disagrees with, other than the view that Lukashenko should not be a dictator who's allowed to act with impunity.
I completely agree. And I've seen nothing suggesting that the claims about Protasevich's politics are true. But as you say, even if they were, the idea that Lukashenko forced down an airliner because of his deeply felt anti-fascism.
Right. It's like, can we focus? Can we just focus on what's happening here?
Yeah. But I think Navalny's an interesting case as well, because it's another example of one of these figures who, from, in his case, a short and temporary exile, were still able to influence politics in their own countries. Navalny famously published his video about Putin's alleged opulent palace on the Black Sea while he was away in Germany recovering from his poisoning. And I think it's an interesting thread that runs through all of these cases, which is that, and this is the point I make in the magazine, that previously, when you were sent into exile or forced into exile, there wasn't much you could do to play a role in the politics back in your home country. But in the last 10 or 20 years, that's transformed through Twitter, Telegram, WhatsApp, and so forth. You're just then seeing autocrats be even more brazen in their moves to take down these extraterritorial dissidents from afar in defiance of international rules and norms. Anyway, an interesting case, and that's certainly a story that's not over, so we'll continue to follow it, and we might even do an episode, I think, on it sometime soon, because it's an important one. But with that, we have a very important issue to tackle for this week's episode. The G7 is looming down on us. It's going to take place from the 11th to the 13th of June in Cornwall. So it's being hosted this year by the British government. And it comes at a time when there's been a lot of discussion about Britain's place in the world. Naturally, with Brexit now formalized, the big question is, where does Britain go outside of the European Union? What sort of role does it play? And contributing to that was the publication in March of the British government's new integrated review on foreign and security policy, which to some extent pointed the way that the government wants the country to go. And as part of our coverage of that, we had a very excellent essay out in April by our special correspondent, Harry Lambert, who writes about a range of topics about the UK, but also other topics, and is with us this week to discuss his essay and to preview the G7. So, Harry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Good
pleasure.
To be on.
So I wanted to start off with a very broad question, drawing on your essay, Harry, in which you quote a former British ambassador to Washington, himself quoting Anthony Crossland, who talked about Britain being pulled between, on the one hand, its blue water identity or its global identity and its European identity. And I suppose the big question now is, has leaving the European Union helped to resolve that tension in how Britain sees its place in the world, do you think?
Well, I don't think it's resolved the tension, but I just think it's changed the dynamic, you know, the relative weight of the equation, if you like. The ambassador in question, Christopher Mayer, says that, you know, after we joined the EEC in 1973, the pendulum swung towards the continent, having long been much more, Britain's role, of course, under the empire and then the Commonwealth was more outward facing, apart from when we were dragged into the continent's affairs by periodic wars. We would often look to the seas. And so obviously that changed over the last 50 years. And, you know, Mayer's point is that's now just swinging back. The big thing that I discovered doing this piece in April now, but I've been looking at it since the start of the year, is, you know, you think of Brexit as this great rupture, this great change in the social dynamic of the UK. And it is in many ways. But at the same time, the more I spoke to people inside Number 10 and across the sort of foreign policy establishment, if you like, the more I kind of started to think that the degree of movement here is not actually that great. And that Global Britain is, you know, as so often in politics, just a new brand name for a plan that is, you know, not all that different from the plan we had over the last 40 years. Now, there will be some, like a Jonathan Powell, who's mentioned in the piece and was chief of staff for Tony Blair in Number 10 for 10 years. People like Powell will say to you, well, that's just wrong, that the Global Britain strategy, such as it is, has a great big hole, he said to me, where Europe should be. And we've never had a coherent foreign policy without a Europe policy. So that's the great question. Has British foreign policy taken a big hit? Is there now a great big hole? Or in fact, is this quite similar to where we were 10 years ago? That's the big question, I think.
It kind of sounds like you think that it's not a great big hole, that this is different, but in a way a continuation of the same. So I guess, what do you say to those like Powell who say there's a gaping hole?
Well, look, Jonathan Powell knows more about global affairs than I do. And if he thinks so, then, you know, I'm willing to reserve judgment. At the same time, I think it partly comes down to my view of Brexit, which is, I think Brexit is something which will be watered down over time. I think a Number 10 source said to me that our long run standing in Europe has been sort of deliberately left ajar, they said, by the strategy. And it's quite possible that Britain's role with Europe could become closer over time. And they think the strategy provides for that. So I guess, you know, another response to Powell is less that whether or not he's wrong, but just for how long is it the case that Britain remains in this sort of slightly fractious dynamic with Europe? Or is it the case that over the next decade and certainly into the 2030s, especially on foreign policy matters, we just come closer and closer and closer? I don't know what would you two say?
Just on this, I mean, I haven't been following this as closely as you have, but on when the Integrated Review was published, I did a short column in which I talked about the fact, as you've observed yourself, that that Europe was this missing piece in the Integrated Review, for example. The government doesn't really want to seem to engage with the question of where Europe fits into its foreign policy vision, presumably because it's a difficult one and the Conservative Party is divided on it and it involves some difficult trade-offs. But the point I made was certainly actually looking at the UK from the outside, from Germany, you know, looking at where transatlantic relations are, looking at the kind of wider geopolitical picture, it would seem to me that actually an area where where Britain, actually irrespective of Brexit, can most influence its own interests and influence the things that should matter to it would actually be in Europe's own neighbourhood. You know, you look, I mean, even in the last few weeks, at the uncertainty in the Baltic around Belarus, but also bear in mind that, you know, nearby in Estonia, Britain's leading NATO's enhanced forward presence as a defense against particularly Russian military aggression. You look at the instability in Ukraine and the recent buildup of Russian troops on its eastern border. You look at the tensions between Greece and Turkey, where Britain does actually have quite an important role, particularly through its relationship with Cyprus. You look at instability in the Middle East, Israel-Palestine most recently. You look at North Africa and the way in which Europe, including the UK's security, seems increasingly to be bound up with events on the other side of the Sahara. You look at this great crescent around the UK, and it seems to me that that's where, in many ways, the most important changes are taking place that affect British security and, in many ways, British prosperity. And then on top of that, I'd add, and perhaps here, Emily, you could come in on the American perspective, but it seems to me that, you know, Britain wants to be a relevant partner to the US. It wants to maintain this special relationship. It wants to probably intensify it after Brexit. It seems clear that Biden does not want to get caught up in conflicts or crises in this part of the world, by which I mean with regards to Russia, maybe, but certainly in the Middle East. I mean, he was very clear that he didn't want to get sucked into a new Israel-Palestine conflict. And actually, you know, for a US that wants to pivot to the contest with China into the Pacific, as Biden clearly wants to do, you know, one would think that while it's tempting and probably quite glamorous to say we'll pivot to the Indo-Pacific, which is obviously a big part of this global Britain strategy, and perhaps, Harry, you could talk a bit more about this Indo-Pacific pivot and what they mean by that. It's obviously a sort of tempting idea, but one wonders if the UK couldn't actually be more valuable to Biden and his administration by standing up for security and stability in this European neighbourhood where the US actually doesn't want to be so focused at the moment. So anyway, that's a sort of long way of saying my instinct from the outside is that actually Britain should still be thinking, even after Brexit, about having more, not less of a role in security terms and in foreign policy terms in its own and indeed Europe's sort of shared neighbourhood. Anyway, Emily, first of all, could we hear from you on this? What's your perspective about what the US needs and wants from Britain?
I guess I would say two things. The first is that it's very important to the United States that the UK and the EU continue to have good working relations, right? I think it's the kind of thing where we're not going to get involved, we being, you know, the American government. The American government's not going to necessarily get involved and be like, now you two cooperate. But this shouldn't be a headache for the US. I think the US perspective is we have enough headaches. We don't need our two pals not getting along and making life more difficult for us, particularly on matters of security and defense. The other thing I would say, and I have a piece coming out on this next month, so I don't want to give away too. No, I'm just kidding. I'll give it all away. For you, the New Statesman World Review listeners.
What's the point of being a podcast listener if not to get previews?
Yeah, exactly.
Our listeners get some.
But you know, and basically, the question is: does the United States need a global Britain? And look, I think by which I mean, does the United States need a Britain that has a foreign policy that is confident, that is ambitious, that is coherent? If Britain can't do that, are we going to sink into the sea? No, but it will be much worse for the United States on both the British near abroad and the farther abroad, right? As Jeremy said, I think there is a portfolio that the United States would be happy to have Britain on which Biden would, or most American presidents for that matter, would be happy to have Britain and the EU do more. And Britain is, you know, just spends much more on defense than the EU, than various European countries do, is in Five Eyes, the intelligentsary group, which these European countries are not. And also, you know, I think there was this, and I've complained about this on this podcast before, but there's this line among some that, oh, Britain's out of the EU, and so it lost its role as the go-between between the US and Europe. And it's just like, that has not been America's relationship to either of these entities in so long. All these presidents have their own relationships with Germany, with France, with the EU as an institution, and will continue to have that. And none of those countries, when the US calls, are listening as intently to what the US suggests it do as Britain is. I've had this discussion with some, you know, British foreign policy types who basically say, yeah, but we can't just have, you know, on China, on the Indo-Pacific, what good are we if we can't bring others along? And it's like, I don't know if you've met the United States, but we love people who just listen to us, right? Like, there aren't that many allies and partners of the United States who are willing to spend a lot of money, invest a lot of time, have this ambitious, far-reaching foreign policy, and work closely with the United States and try to set a model for others, which I think Britain could do on, for example, this plan to have a common global tax rate. So basically, that's my long-winded answer of saying that both are really important. It's important to the United States that Britain and the EU get along, and it's important to the United States that Britain continues to look both at its close borders and farther away.
You know, first of all, on that idea of us as the great negotiator between Europe and America, that is the kind of Jonathan Powell view. And I think, you know, Christopher Mayer is one of the many people who push back against that and say that we've just never had that role, as you yourself are saying. And more to the point, you know, Mayer's point and the point of others is we don't need to have that role. Like, that's not why we are close allies with America, ultimately, as you're saying. And as number 10 kind of concede, you know, their view is, if you're the United States, what do you want out of an ally? You want someone that pretty much is just like Britain. You know, their view is America wants allies who share its values, who focus on human rights, who care about democracy and climate change, who spend over 2% of their GDP on defense, you know, committing to the language of burden sharing, as they like to put it. And, you know, allies who can also help diplomatically as we can with our seat on the UN Security Council. A number 10 advisor said to me, if I'm the Americans, I therefore look to the Brits above anyone else. And so it's not about us having a special relationship with them. You know, Christopher Mayer says the only countries in the world that have a special relationship with America are Ireland and Israel, because only those two countries can actually affect domestic American politics, which I thought was a really interesting point. I hadn't thought about that way before. And just finally, Jeremy, on your point, you know, this idea of us kind of dealing with our nearby crescent, I think the reason why number 10 justify the tilt to the Indo-Pacific rather than doing that is because that would be sort of second division football. You know, it's all very well saying we can take care of this area of the world that you're not that interested in. But number 10 feel like all their analysis pointed to the Indo-Pacific as the place where the key powers were going to be negotiating the 21st century, and they wanted to be on the playing field. Now, you can argue whether that's a foolish aim, but I think that would be their response to why you don't focus on just your sort of own internal affairs. You don't want to be playing in the G League when America's in the NBA.
So I think an important question, follow-up question, on which I'd be very interested to hear what you discovered, is what do they think Britain can bring to the Indo-Pacific at America's side?
Well, I think this is the great question, and this is a question I've tried to ask and sometimes felt at a loss, because, you know, we obviously have two aircraft carriers, and we're famously sending one of them as part of the strike force that's doing a sort of patrol around the South China Sea at the moment.
In fact, actually, that's leaving any day now, isn't it? I know Johnson did a visit to Portsmouth about a week or so ago to sort of see it off. Anyway, yes,
that's an important moment. So we're sending a boat, and we're going to join, you know, things like ASEAN as a sort of diplomatic partner, you know, a local Asian power body. But the reality is, and I think I put this to number 10, you know, how can we really be involved over there? And I wouldn't say they gave me a strong answer as to how exactly we can be involved over there. So I'm not going to suggest one now. But, you know, they believe that you just have to kind of make noises in the right direction. Events will pop up in the area, and it's key to sort of have a military presence, have a diplomatic presence, stay involved economically. You know, one of the frustrations with researching a subject like foreign policy is you talk to former ambassadors to Japan or what have you in the region, and you kind of get them to nail down what the job is of foreign policy. And you do end up hearing these words like economically, militarily, diplomatically, and you think, what do they all like exactly add up to, and what do you mean by that? And it takes a while to kind of get beyond the broad terms.
I mean, Emily, can I ask you a slightly more specific version of the question I asked you before? What does the US want from the UK in the Indo-Pacific? I mean, what do we know about the Biden approach to the competition with China, to its attempt to forge closer relationship with the likes of Japan and Australia and India and so forth?
Yeah,
that we could bring to this reflection on the UK.
I actually think that more than anything that they're physically doing in the Indo-Pacific, the more useful thing, the more relevant thing to the United States, and I'm sure US defense types would disagree with me on this, but is what's done in the UK with respect to China, right? So on Hong Kong, or on speaking out against what's happening to the Uyghurs, or on working with the United States on sanctions, if it comes to that, on which the UK now has more flexibility because it's not in the EU, right? Or on, approaching trade more similarly than the US does with respect to China than does Germany, for example. Harry, what do you think? If the UK is going to be useful on the Indo-Pacific, do you think that it's going to be useful in London or abroad, or both or neither?
I think we should move away a little bit from thinking in terms of the Indo-Pacific, because I think the reality is the Indo-Pacific is just sort of the surface layer analysis of what's just happened with Global Britain and the Integrated Review. You know, no doubt we can be helpful through the UN as number 10.2 on stuff like the Uyghurs. And, you know, we can play a role there, though it will be minor. That's inevitable. And just more ask, you know, what is the point of British foreign policy? How much does it change? And when has it been successful? I think the number 10 view is that there's this sort of hegemony of thought that the last 20 years of British foreign policy before Brexit were a success. And they push back and they say, what were the great successes of British foreign policy over the last 20 years? There haven't been any. So I think their main view is rather than be so critical of the Indo-Pacific tilt, is just to say, it's not like we have had a particularly successful 15, 20 years. Libya wasn't a success. Iraq wasn't a success. And so the idea of just trying to involve ourselves more in an area should be met with less indignation and condescension. You know, they hate the idea that we should sort of humbly submit to our geography. And they say the French and the Germans have long detailed what their plans are in the Indo-Pacific. And when they do so, they don't get criticized with quite the same sort of delusions of grandeur that our press like to level at them.
And I also think that from the US perspective, look, it would be pretty easy for Britain to say, actually, we don't need this. Like, we don't need to be doing this. We don't need to be spending all of this money on intelligence, on defense, on foreign policy. We're going to, you know, we're going to take care or tend to our own garden and enjoy America, your, you know, your foreign policy misadventures. And that would be really bad for the United States, right? To have a more inward, to have an inward facing Britain that's not interested. I mean, forget the Indo-Pacific, but that's just not interested in foreign policy engagement in the same way that that they are now. You know, do I think that the UK is going to come back and like rule the Indo-Pacific? No, of course not. But do I think that the United States should be encouraging them to be playing a thoughtfully active, non-imperialistic role in the Indo-Pacific? Sure.
Yeah, I think just on that, you know, Tom Tugendhat, the Conservative chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee in the UK, said to me, you know, quipped, we could just fall back and guard Dover. You know, there is that strand of thinking, like, why are we still trying to involve ourselves in foreign conflicts? Why don't we just sort of take the turn that Denmark took at the turn of the last century and, you know, retreat from empire and retreat from ambitions to involve ourselves far afield? And that's a question I still think is interesting to ask. And it's really hard to ask people in the foreign policy establishment that question, because it's just so axiomatic that to be a powerful nation, you exercise power, as Tom Fletcher said to me, who was a foreign affairs advisor in Downing Street for Gordon Brown and others. So, you know, it's just very hard to get people who are actually involved in the decision making to think about whether we should retreat, because that's seen as defeat.
One of the things that seems to me surprisingly sort of secondary in a lot of this, certainly in terms of the thinking coming out of the current government, and maybe I've just misunderstood it, but it's the impression I get, is that there isn't yet, and maybe it's a work in progress, a clear vision of what Britain's interests are. Like, we have these theories about how the world's changing. We have these theories about the arenas that are going to matter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's that old phrase, I think it's attributed to Palmerston, there are no permanent allies, no permanent enemies, just permanent interests. Mm-hmm. And it's true that there is clearly a case for European countries to get involved in the Indo-Pacific. And you're right that the fact that that France and Germany had their own Indo-Pacific strategies suggests that this isn't just an act of post-imperial nostalgia on the part of the kind of the Brexit government mm-hmm. in London. But what I miss, particularly from the way that Europe is this sort of vacuum in the foreign policy thinking, or certainly in the integrated review, insofar as that's a representative vision of how Downing Street see these things. And, you know, it seems to me that if you don't have a clear argument about what Britain needs from its security and foreign policy relationship with the continent of which it is geographically part, and the continent whose security threats, whose economic stability or instability, whose political situation you are very exposed to through movements of people or goods, or the fact that it's still by far your largest trading partner. The fact that isn't there doesn't, I have to say, give me confidence that big conversation about exactly where Britain's interests lie has been taking place. Perhaps it's happening, and perhaps I'm just not seeing so much of it. And I'm, as I say, I'm watching this from afar, from Berlin. But I guess that's something that concerns me.
Well, I think it's really hard to get the British government to say what its interests are. I kept wanting in my research to sort of come across a big book that detailed all our plans for every country and what we, you know, what we wanted to do. But it's, maybe that document exists inside the Foreign Office, but I haven't seen it. And so you're left with very broad statements. You know, I get told that the UK has made a punt on openness, barriers to trade being reduced is the great opportunity for Britain. And, you know, people say, well, hang on, what about Brexit? And the way number 10 see it, and maybe they're wrong, is that the EU is fundamentally quite a large regulatory and protectionist bloc. And it's much better to be outside a bloc like that over time, because they think the world is going to open up. They think those sort of blocs are going to be less relevant to the trading order of the future, which is a whole big question in itself. But, you know, in answer more specifically to sort of what are our core five interests, you know, one of the frustrating things is the length of the integrated review and the variety of interests and aims that it identifies. And that's in real contrast to the beauty of British foreign policy after the war, when Attlee and the Labour government reduced our aims to three pillars, the famous three-pillar strategy.
Wherever you are in the world,
if you're interested in global affairs,
you can subscribe to The New Statesman on digital, in print, or both from as little as £1 a week at newstatesman.com/subscribe.
That's just $2 a week in America.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That, I think, is a good moment to come onto a section that we like to call...
You Ask Us.
Our question this week, and Harry, I will invite you to take the first go at it, is how much is at stake for the British government at the G7 summit? So as I said earlier on, this is starting in 2 weeks' time as this podcast goes out. It's going to be in Cornwall in the southwest of England. There's clearly a sense that the British government will be on show and put to the test. But how important do you think it is, Harry? And what should we expect from it? What's the Johnson government's game plan?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. When you ask some attendees this question, they say, yeah, the main aim is just to get it working again after Trump, because it was such an inglorious period for the G7. And, you know, since I spoke to those inside number 10, you've obviously seen a lot of action on things like a global minimum tax for corporations. And that would be a big win. I think a bigger win than they were expecting, frankly, when I was researching the piece. There's loads on the agenda. They want to, you know, they're bringing in India, South Korea, Australia, and South Africa to form a sort of D11 of global democracies. And, you know, they want to build on that. Just to undermine that slightly, you know, people like Jonathan Powell say previous G7s, they've invited countries and those groupings so often exist for a month and then they're gone the next month. So we'll see if ideas like the D11 have any legs.
Yeah, and of course it's going to be a significant moment because it will be Joe Biden's first trip abroad since becoming president. Emily, how's it seen from Washington? What will people be watching?
Well, two things. I've been asked by some, you know, what does it mean that this is his first foreign trip? First of all, it means that there was a pandemic. But secondly, I think even if there had not been a pandemic, his first or an early trip would have been to Britain, to the EU, because it's part of this Biden's promise that America is back, that America is reasserting itself on the international stage. I guess the domestic version of this is that we've already had the Japanese prime minister and South Korean president visit the White House, right, to kind of reestablish the importance of those alliances too after Trump. I would say two other things. The first is that I've been a little surprised at how negative some in conservative circles in British media were toward Biden. And my point, which I think I made on this podcast, was kind of like, If you set aside that most Democrats back in 2016 were opposed to Brexit, this will actually, a Biden presidency will be better for you guys than a Trump presidency, right? He's going to be more interested in multilateralism. He's going to be more interested in working together. He's going to be more predictable in what he does. And I think that we'll see that at the G7, right? I do not think that we will see a repeat of, like, if Biden were to throw candy at Merkel, as Trump reportedly did, I would fall out of my chair, right? That I just don't think that that's going to happen. Whether the G7 does anything more than show that these institutions are back, right? That we can have world leaders together and it won't be a complete circus. Like, yes, it will do that. Can it do more than that, right? Can we actually use these? What is the point of these multilateral gatherings? What can they put forth? What can they achieve? That, I think, is what people in Washington will be, at least skeptics of Biden's foreign policy in Washington, will be looking at.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to look at it. You know, the G7 itself being under scrutiny as people ask, is this the right way to do international leadership and governance? And I think for the UK government, as you say, Harry, this is a great opportunity to host the G7 summit at which people will if it goes well, say the West is back. The transatlantic relationship is back. Multilateralism is back. The Trump years are over. This is grown up, responsible, democratic governments working together like they should have been doing for the last 4 years, but were obstructed from doing by the then American president. However, I think the flip side of that is that there are probably quite high expectations. You know, Biden comes into this very willing to make ambitious agreements on things like the climate and also things like this common global tax framework. But I suppose if it is perceived as being a bit of a damp squib, and by the way, as I understand it, the UK government's currently the one most standing in the way of this agreement on tax, partly because it has unusually low corporate tax rates for a large Western economy, that if it is seen as a damp squib, then one wonders, it feels, just looking at international debates, like an open question as to what sort of format global governments decide is the right level at which to do this sort of summitry. You know, there have been talk of do you maybe start reviving the G20, which has sort of been a bit on the back foot in the last years. It obviously came together during the financial crisis as a forum to deal with global economic instability. But I suppose the question is now, particularly now that the G7 itself represents an ever smaller share of the global economy, although, as you say, Harry, they are adding in other countries like India as supplementary participants. Mm-hmm. You know, another idea that's in the ether, which I don't know that it's that realistic, but I think is an interesting idea of where some of the discussions are going, and I wrote about this recently, is this idea of a new global concert of powers, where you have six major powers of various different political complexions sit together and make the big decisions in a kind of non-ideological way. And that would, I think, be this was put forward by Richard Haass of the Council for Foreign Relations. And it would, I think, be sort of India, China, the US, Japan, the EU, and Russia. And it was noted, because this brings us back to our main topic in this conversation, that Britain was not included in that by Haass and his co-writer. And they actually said that, yes, we're not including the UK in this, but we think that this will help the UK to push the UK and the EU together. Now, as I said, I don't know how realistic this idea is, but I think it goes to show that people are having, you know, there are discussions going on about, is the G7 the right forum? Is the G20? Do you need to create something else? What role does the UN have?
I agree that there probably should be some new combination of countries, but I also think that we risk privileging form over substance in some of these conversations, right? Like, is the problem with the G7 that it's these seven countries and they meet in this way or at this time? Or is the problem that they are not clear on what it is that they're trying to achieve? Like, what is the point of these multilateral gatherings, right? And I say this as a, I think if you listen to this podcast, you know that I'm not an America first type, not to give too much away. But, you know, as a believer in multilateralism and as a believer in internationalism and the reality of globalization, like, we clearly need some kind of convenings, but is that the only reason we're convening? Like, what are we trying to do here? And I think that while, yes, it's fair and right and good to ask the question of what is the best combination, how should they meet, et cetera, that is not a substitute for what they're doing.
That is really the key point. What are they trying to do here? What is the UK trying to do here? And it may be worth to just spell out what that three pillars strategy I mentioned earlier was in 1948. And just listen to the simplicity of this. They said the security of the British Commonwealth depended on A, the defense of the UK, B, maintaining vital sea communications, and C, securing the Middle East as a defensive and striking base against the Soviet Union. Now, of course, they had other aims that were secondary, but it's just an era that was completely different to the era we now live in, when a government would openly state with great simplicity what they were trying to do. And, you know, we have these conversations about the G7 and what it can achieve, because it's now so much less clear what governments want to do, right? They have so many different aims, and we can't just imagine them sitting down and saying, well, look, these are my three big focuses. How can we work together on that?
It's also the reality, which I suppose gets to this larger question, that we're in a multipolar world, and it's not simply a case of picking a side. Even on China, I mean, as much as people make the comparisons with the Cold War, I don't think that's a relevant or useful historical comparison. There is a competition between China and the West, but actually, you know, the UK, I think, sums this up. You know, even the UK, which is trying to align itself very closely with the US in this, more so certainly than continental Europe and most of the EU is these days, it's still going to face complicated trade-offs that I think are more complicated than those faced based certainly on the fundamental choices by the post-war UK, by Attlee's UK. You know, you say, Harry, that there's this view in number 10 that Britain needs to be a force for openness, and it will be, that will be its calling card in the world. And that's a fairly clear, and I can kind of understand what they're getting with that. You can dispute whether or not it's true that the EU is such a protectionist force, but just you can see where they're coming from. And then, you know, the question becomes, well, if you're a force for openness and you also want to be one of America's closest allies with regards to the competition with China, where does that leave your trade policy with China? Are you rushing in to try and do trade deals? Are you preferencing open and extensive trade with China over other geopolitical concerns? Where do you stand on those trade-offs? And I just think in that sort of world, it is nothing. Things are not that simple. Yeah, maybe we have to get used to the idea that government foreign policy strategies need to be hundreds of pages long rather than three short, simple statements of principle. I don't know.
You might be absolutely right about that. And I think the trade-off you described there is the one that obviously lots of powers and countries all over the East are having to make all the time. An ambassador in the region saying, you know, so many of the countries there, they look economically to China and militarily to the US. And that's the great tension we're going to see play out over the next couple of decades, isn't it?
You know, there was this idea that I think has kind of been abandoned, but we'll see, on that Biden floated of convening democracies. Basically, Harry, between that and, you know, there was this great brouhaha this week over Orban coming to London and meeting Johnson, and how could, you know, he meet the Hungarian prime minister, which, first of all, neither the US nor the UK is the primary, quote unquote, Western power that has emboldened Orban's Hungary. But leaving that to the side, I guess this is a long way of asking, like, what role do you think our stated values at least should have in dictating these convenings? Like, is that what matters, or is it your economic level, your national security posture? What do you think, for the UK at least, let's say, what do you think should be the deciding? If you, Harry, were put in charge of putting these convenings together, would values be a metric?
I'm less interested by my changeable view, which, you know, may change from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Than in the British government's attempt to sort of solve these questions. And I mean, that's meant as no slight on the question, but just to say the...
No, no, that's fine. You can shade my question. It's all right. I won't take it personally. Won't remember it. We're not colleagues. No, we are. And I will remember it. No, sorry, go on.
You know, the way the governments see it and the way they've tried to adjudicate it is they say, look, we meet people all the time that we don't agree with. They met with Ali Bongo, the Gabonese president just the other week, and they no more agree with his ideas than they do with Viktor Orban's. But it always pays to talk to global leaders. That they say, you know, effective work needs to be done on organized crime and serious crime that the Hungarian government can help the British government with. They also, of course, have interests in Europe that it can pay to talk to Orban with. Look, I would love to be able to solve the great dilemma between, you know, values and political reality, but I'm not sure I can.
Well, Harry has rejected my question. If you would like to send our next guest more questions, please keep them coming into You Ask Us at podcasts@newstatesman.co.uk.
So that brings us to our look ahead to the next week in world affairs, or indeed in domestic politics. Harry, what will you be looking ahead to in the next 7 days?
Well, I think the fallout over here from the Dominic Cummings trial, while that might seem insular, it is remarkable. It's like Bannon, you know, and Trump.
For someone who has not had the pleasure of encountering the personality of Dominic Cummings, can you just give us a quick overview of who he is and why he matters?
Yeah. So think about it this way. 5 years ago this month, Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings were both fighting to take Britain out of the EU. Dominic Cummings was the key strategist behind that campaign. Boris Johnson was the key front man. They were working together. Cummings famously had Johnson stand in front of a big bus pledging money to the NHS if the British would only leave the EU. They won that referendum. After much delay, 3 years later, they got into government because the Tory party faced an extinction level event over Brexit, and they returned to Boris Johnson to solve that problem. And he returned to Dominic Cummings and said, come and help me fix this problem that we started in 2016. They worked together to win an election in 2019 very successfully. And in the years since, they have spectacularly fallen out. Yesterday, or rather, was it on Wednesday, the former chief aide to Johnson Cummings was in front of Parliament's two select committees on health and science and answered questions for 7 hours with no restraint and with complete condemnation of Boris Johnson and some of the key figures in his government. And the ramifications of that will reverberate through Westminster all through the next week.
So one worth watching. Emily, how about you?
I'm delighted that we finally got to talk about Dominic Cummings on the World Review podcast. I will not be watching Dominic Cummings, though. I will be watching, you know, I think it was pretty clear coming into this administration that Biden did not want to get bogged down in the Middle East, specifically in Israel-Palestine, and events have forced his hand, right? So Secretary of State Tony Blinken went to the region to meet with Netanyahu and Egyptian President Sisi and with Palestinians. There's going to be continued pressure in Washington from Biden's left flank to change U.S. policy toward Israel-Palestine. How the U.S. engages, the extent to which it continues to engage, whether or not it changes. I think the reality is that if the U.S. just keeps the status quo, that's not being involved, right? We just provide so much, not just military aid, but diplomatic support to Israel. And so I will be watching, although there was a ceasefire, fortunately, over Gaza, obviously the conflict itself continues. And I will be watching both that and the U.S. posture, specifically the Biden administration's posture toward it. And I should also say that the background, or not the background, but along with all of this, they're trying to restart, they're continuing Iran talks, right, on the nuclear deal. So, which is obviously a contentious issue with respect to Israel, which was staunchly opposed to the Iran nuclear deal. So it's not just this one issue, although that issue, like, even if it were that one issue, that would be significant and difficult, both obviously for the people there, but also for the Biden administration. But there's this whole other extremely complicated negotiation going on that further complicates matters.
I will be looking ahead to the growing chorus of calls for the Olympics in Tokyo to be cancelled or heavily reined back. They're due to start now in under 2 months on the 23rd of July. And the numbers of people, of authorities or experts saying that they think they should not go ahead is now rising. Yesterday, as this podcast goes out, a Japanese doctors union said that the games going ahead could mean that you might even end up with a new strain of the virus, because the risk is that you'd have people arriving from all different parts of the world with other strains, and that those would sort of mix and mutate, and that you could even end up with as they put it, an Olympic strain of the coronavirus, which is a rather horrifying thought. You know, there's growing evidence that the Japanese public is against it. The country's second biggest newspaper yesterday came out as well against it. An American medical body has come out and said it's a bad idea. And it's obviously very difficult, because the Olympics were already postponed one time since last year. The IOC has said that they won't let it be postponed again, because we've already got the Winter Olympics coming up next spring. So it's either a case of cancelling it or going ahead with it. For the Japanese government, obviously, there's a huge amount of sunk investment and national pride involved. And so it's a really, really difficult one. But the government in Tokyo is due to say in the next few weeks, they said they would announce in June at some point what their policy would be for letting domestic spectators attend events. They've already said that people won't be allowed to enter the country to spectate, but they said Japanese residents will be able to. And even that's now looking questionable. You know, how many people can you put in a stadium safely at the moment? So it's a very sad story, because it would have been a great moment of renewal and healing for the world to have these games go ahead, particularly as originally envisioned. But it's looking like that's going to be more and more difficult. And I'll be watching to see how that story develops, because it doesn't seem like there are any great options on the table. So that's what I'll be watching. All of which brings us to the point where we say a big thank you to Harry Lambert, special correspondent at The New Statesman, for joining us for this really interesting conversation. Thank you, Harry.
Thank you very much for having me.
And listeners, as usual, we will be putting the pieces discussed in this episode on the episode page for the podcast, including Harry's great essay on the debates about Britain's future foreign policy. So that's all, as usual, going to be on newstatesman.com/world-review-podcast.
If you have enjoyed this episode of The World Review, please like, subscribe, spread the word, leave a review, call your cousins, tell them about it. And as a reminder, we have a free newsletter component of The World Review, to which you can subscribe at newstatesman.com/world-review.
Our producer has been Chris Stone. Thank you for listening, and until next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.